From WHYY in Philadelphia, I'm Terry Gross, and this is Fresh Air. On today's edition of Fresh Air, I speak with film director Louis Malle. His new film, Au Revoir les Enfants, or Goodbye Children, has just been nominated for 2 Academy Awards. Also, best-selling novelist Rita Mae Brown has a new book of advice to writers. She says, if you're a writer who's female and gay, watch out. We find out why. Irish musician Mick Maloney plays a couple of songs in our weekly performance spot. And critic-at-large Laurie Stone examines the humor of that master of self-deprecation, Rodney Dangerfield. That's all coming up on today's Fresh Air. French filmmaker Louis Malle moved to America 10 years ago. Here he made the films Pretty Baby, Atlantic City, My Dinner with Andre, Crackers, and Alamo Bay. He returned to France to make his new film Au Revoir les Enfants, or Goodbye Children. It was just nominated for Academy Awards in the categories Best Foreign Language Film and Best Screenplay. Like his earlier film La Combe Lucienne, Au Revoir les Enfants is set in occupied France during World War II. The screenplay is inspired by what Malle describes as the most tragic memory of his childhood. In 1944, Malle's parents sent him away from Paris to a Catholic boarding school in the countryside where they thought he'd be protected from the war. But the school was helpless when one morning the Gestapo came looking for the Jewish students who were given sanctuary by the priests. In the notes to the film, Malle writes, "That morning of 1944 changed my life. It may have triggered my becoming a filmmaker." I asked him to explain.
You know, it's a little difficult for me to say that and be completely sure, but it has been such a traumatic event at the age of 11 for me, and they're suddenly exposed to violence and their intolerance and, this brutality, the shock that it was for me to see those German soldiers enter our classroom and arrest one of the, one of the boys who happened to be my friend. I think it has really, long after, well, until now, as a matter of fact, but in the following years, I've been, as I was growing up, I've been trying to understand, and of course, there's nothing to understand. It's just impossible. So what happened is, I suppose what it sort of developed in me is a sort of real tenacious curiosity about trying to find out what was going on in the world outside, and I know my reaction in the following years was a reaction of anger. I couldn't understand. Of course, it was completely unacceptable. I started becoming very rebellious and very cautious about everything I heard from the adults and teachers and my parents, and would try to convince me that was right or was true, and I wanted to find out for myself. And I think that really has triggered my urge to become a filmmaker. I thought making film was a way to try to find out about what was going on around, outside.
Your new movie is based on your childhood experience in a Catholic boarding school during the war. Did something in your life happen now that intensified those memories or that made them especially timely for you now?
Well, it took all those years, and it's just that I suppose the fact that I've been living and working in the U.S. for the last 10 years, because I was far from my roots, and also simply because, I got older, a lot of things of my past, and especially of my childhood, and especially everything around this event of my childhood, the arrestation of my friend Bonnet, and his being deported to Germany, a lot of it came back, and it became a little obsessive, very obsessive. And so it seemed like I had no choice. The same way for years I was scared to deal with it, and I was not ready. Then at some point I felt, well, the time has come. I must cope with it. I must try to write a screenplay, and if the screenplay seems to work, I should make a film.
Maybe there are advantages to waiting that long and having a certain emotional distance from the event?
Yes, there are several advantages, I suppose. I could have made that film when I was 25, you know, my first feature. But since I didn't do it and didn't want to do it then, I suppose it was much better for me to wait, because first, I think I was a little more on top of it as a filmmaker, and I was more in control of the medium, and I always felt I should wait because I wanted to be really completely, you know, trying to make the best film as I could. And it seemed to me that time was working my way. And I think it was the right time for me to do it before, I don't know, before I die, before I become Gaga or whatever. But I thought it was really the right moment. And of course, emotionally, living with this memory all these years, it's not, memory is not dead. It's very much alive. It moves all the time. Things happen. You look at it differently when you get older.
Can I ask you something? You know, some of us have had a chance to see the movie already, and in some cities it's first about to open. And we'll know your memory from the movie that we see. But could I ask you to describe what it was like for you in real life the day the Nazis came into your school and took away one of your friends?
Well, what I can say is, what I remember very well is it was an incredible shock. And I remember that for minutes it seemed like, I don't know, like a bad dream. It didn't seem that it was possible. It seems like it was almost like in slow motion. It was something happening that not only myself, but the other boys in the classroom, we couldn't even comprehend what was going on. And then when they told us the school was closed, we had to pack, and we would have to line up in the courtyard, and we saw our friends taken away by the Germans. It seemed like, it was an incredible shock. It's probably especially for me because of my friendship with Bunny, but for instance, my older brother, who was in a different grade, and none of the children was, the Jewish children were in his grade, but still for him it was also something that he's going to remember until he dies.
My guest is director Louis Malle, and he wrote and directed the new film Au revoir les enfants, which has just been nominated for two Academy Awards. You work with child actors in this movie, children of, I guess, like 10 to 13, or something around there?
Yes.
I understand that you don't like to use professional child actors. Why is that?
Well, it's almost for practical reasons, because there's not too many child actors around anyway, at least in France, and the one I interviewed were not really actors. You know, how could you really learn your craft when you're that young and still going to school? And at the same time, I'm always when I deal with child actors, I always realize that they might have lost something. They might have lost their innocence, and they're not really children anymore. So for me, it was a lot simpler to start from scratch, and to find great children who'd never seen a movie camera before, and to find them, to work with them, finally to choose them, and to trust them with playing the characters. It's a very long process, and it takes a certain amount of tenacity and instinct and experience. But I've done that before, because I've made lots of films with children, and it's always been very rewarding, because I've been able to find most of the time, especially with Au revoir les enfants, the two protagonists are the best children I ever worked with. You know, they're more than actors. They're just great human beings. It was my luck to find them, in a way.
Since the children don't have any acting technique, they're not professional actors, they're very young, do you have to change your directing style to give them a different kind of direction than you'd give an adult actor?
Yes, you have to do that. And that's something that, you know, there's no rule. There's no... You have to really play by ear. But basically, first what I must say is that, you know, the technique of the craft of film acting for children, for some reason, and I'm not the only one to have observed that, the good one, the gifted one, they seem to learn it very, very fast. And actually, at halfway through the shooting, they were just as experienced, it seemed to me, as, I don't know, people who would have been actors, professional actors for 20 years. They would do everything that was required for the camera. They would, you know, I'd never had any problems with them, you know, not knowing their lines or anything like that. I had problems with some of the grown-up actors, but not with with the children. And what you gain is you know, when it works, is also you know, an incredible natural that you don't often have with actors.
This is your first French film in over a decade. Why did you make this film in France? Did you feel that this one had to be made in France since it's set in France and since it's about your youth there?
Well, you know, about 3 or 4 years ago, I'd sort of made up my mind that I was going to do it. So at some point, which was in 86, I went back to Paris. I went back to France, and I started working on the script. And that was my, you know, my sort of re-entry in the French cinema and working in, you know, in my language, the French language, which was, of course, great for me because after all these years, it was very moving and, in a way, easier. But it's not that I wanted to go back and work in France again, which I did in a way, but it's I went back because I wanted to make Au revoir les enfants. That was really what I had in mind. I was obsessed with it, as I said.
Why had you left France a decade ago?
Well, for lots of reasons. I have many answers. I could just say that I came to make a film called Pretty Baby. And I'd been thinking about it and working on it for several years. And again, at that point, I felt I should do it. So it was taking place in New Orleans. It's you know, I had to come and I had to come here to make it, but then I was always interested in the American cinema. I've always been a great admirer of the, at least in the, you know, in the good old days. I think American cinema was the best, and I've always wanted at some point to work here. I was very curious about this country, which I'd visited and known pretty well before I moved here. And so it's sort of, again, it came naturally. I came to make one picture, and I stayed 10 years. I made more pictures. I enjoyed being here. I was always very curious about what was going on in this country, and time has been flying. That's what happened.
You know, you said you really liked American films from the good old days. What were the films that you really liked the most when you were coming of age?
Well, you know, we admired the American cinema for its immediacy. It seemed like, you know, I grew up with two forms of American culture that I still think, you know, the Americans were a little unique about. It was jazz and cinema. It seemed to us that they were means of expression that the Americans were better than Europeans. It might not be true about cinema because there's been some pretty good European films, but we always felt that it had to do with the medium itself, that it was, you know, the Americans were particularly at ease with it. And over the years, you know, I had this incredible admirations for American directors from, I don't know, John Ford to Huston, Preston Sturges, the great comedians. We just, you know, it's it was like a sort of an addiction for us when I was an adolescent and then when I was in film school and, you know, my first years as a filmmaker.
Well, it must have been really exciting to start making films in the 1950s during the period of the French New Wave when all these really young, exciting directors like yourself were coming of age. And the French cinema was a very intellectual cinema, in addition to, like, loving the genre films of America. I mean, directors like you and Truffaut and Godard were intellectuals as well. It wasn't really a part of the American tradition of cinema.
No, you know, there's obviously a contradiction, because in a way we admired, you know, in Jean-Luc Godard's first feature, Breathless, there's a series of homages to the great American filmmakers. But he's completely an intellectual, and his style and approach to filmmaking is completely different. It's the opposite of Hollywood. So in a way, it was a paradox. But I think we've been really nourished by the American school, and we were intellectuals in the sense that we were the first generation where we decided that film was our medium. The generation before, they would have wanted to be novelists.
Or poets, or
playwrights. But for us, cinema was the medium. And actually, through the 60s, it was. It was a very flourishing period for the French cinema. And we sort of took over, and for years it was really exciting. And we were incredibly young. You know, I made my first feature, I was 24 years old, so that was fun and exciting.
You know, it seems to me maybe the French cinema has changed a little bit. There's so many more French comedies coming out now, kind of sitcom type, type comedies. I don't know. What do you think?
You know, Tara, I have to say that what you see in this country of the French cinema does not necessarily reflect the real production. You see some auteur films like Eric Rohmer and a lot of comedies, because for some reason the distributors here think it's going to please American audiences, like Three Men and a Cradle was remade as Three Men and a Baby. But there is a tradition of personal filmmaking in France which continues. Frankly, I'm not sure the French cinema is in a great period. It goes through cycles. The 60s were remarkable. The 80s are certainly not as great. But I have to say that every year they make interesting personal films. A lot of them are not shown here, unfortunately.
Well, I want to talk with you more about filmmaking, but first we're going to take a short break. My guest is film director Louis Malle. His films include Murmur of the Heart, La Comme Lucienne, Atlantic City, and My Dinner with André. His new film, Au Revoir les Enfants, has just opened, and it's been nominated for 2 Academy Awards for Best Foreign Language Film and for Best Screenplay. We'll talk more after this break. This is Fresh Air.
Fresh Air is produced live at WHYY in Philadelphia and distributed by National Public Radio.
Filmmaker Louis Malle is my guest. You know, it really interests me that you got your start in filmmaking working with Jacques Cousteau, the famous underwater filmmaker and documentary filmmaker. Had you sought him out?
Well, I was in film school, and I was very lucky because one summer he asked the director of the school for an apprentice, and I think I was in the school the only one who could swim, so they picked me, and I really wanted to go. I was interested in documentaries. I was interested in Cousteau's work as a filmmaker, which was very interesting. And so I spent 2 months on the Calypso as an apprentice. And at the end of the summer, Cousteau told me that the man who was in charge of filmmaking with him, his assistant, was leaving because he was getting married. And do you want the job? I was not even 20 years old. I was in the middle of film school, and of course I said yes. How could I refuse? And I knew nothing, you know, but I worked very hard, and I learned about editing, photography. I became an underwater cameraman, and we came up 3 years later with a feature documentary called The Silent World. And Cousteau has been incredibly nice and great class, because he offered me to be the co-director, which he didn't have to do. So I was co-director at the age of 23 of a film which won the Golden Palm at the Cannes Festival. The Oscar for feature documentary was an immense success, And so that was my start, and that was an incredible break for me.
You know, it's almost... I'd almost expect that in one of your movies you would have found an underwater scene with someone wrestling an octopus just to
I've been
just to show off your skills there.
For 30 years, but it never happened. I've kept in touch with Cousteau, and he's offered me several times to come back and work with him again, which I would love to do, actually, but it never happened.
Maybe I'm making too much of this, but getting your start in documentary films, did that teach you a certain emotional distance, teach you how to shoot something that was really exciting and compelling without really wringing every bit of emotion out of it?
Well, I don't know. The one thing that it did for me, I got so interested in this kind of direct cinema without a script, just filming... something happening in front of you, I've always found fascinating. And throughout my career, I've kept making personal documentaries about all kinds of subjects. I filmed in India. I film in this country. I made two documentaries in the last few years in America. And this has always been a very important part of my work and very necessary for me to go back to the real world with a camera and... So I think it has certainly had an influence on my fiction work too, but how to define it, I really don't know. What it probably has helped me to sort of define a style where I'm trying to get from the actors I'm directing the same kind of immediacy that I'm dealing with when I'm shooting documentaries.
You know, one of your feature films really walks the line between documentary and fiction film, and I'm thinking of My Dinner with Andre, which was basically a film about a long dinner conversation between Andre Gregory and Wallace Shawn. It's a wonderful movie, and it seems to me it's one of the most self-effacing movies on your part as a director, because it's a movie that really calls attention in a way to the actors and to the screenplay, and you think, well, this must have been easy to direct. It's just two people at a dinner table talking. But it must have been actually very, very difficult to direct a dinner table conversation and keep it as interesting as you did.
To keep it together, it was actually incredibly difficult. It's one of the, of my directing work that has given me more work. It's been really, because it's the whole point. It was when you said self-effacing, that's exactly what I was trying to do. I didn't want to certainly not to show off. I just wanted them to be as good as possible. I wanted the conversation to be as interesting as possible. I wanted the whole thing to work, which was a real challenge, because it seemed absurd to make a film like 2 hours about two characters discussing in a restaurant. So the whole point was at the end that it seemed like I've just been shooting them, and when actually we rehearsed for months. I work with them more than I've ever worked with actors. I think I've directed Wally and Andre Gregory more than I've done ever. And I've done the same thing in a way with Au revoir les enfants, because it was a lot of work, but it's always what I'm trying to do. I hate to show off with the camera. I hate to demonstrate that I'm a good director. I hate to my work to be to be too present. One of the things I'm proud of with Au revoir les enfants, the last one, is that I think the spectator very, very soon forgets that there is a camera. And there's a lot of people have told me it's almost like a different experience that normally you have when you're watching a film. There's such an immediacy between the actors and what's going on the screen and your own emotions watching it, that it's almost there's nobody in between. Of course, in between there's, the work we've done, but it's meant not to show.
Well, as we mentioned before, Au revoir les enfants is your first French film in a decade. When you went back to France to make it, did you think a lot about how, if at all, your directing and filmmaking techniques had changed since you left France for America?
I don't think it has changed too much. I think what I've learned here is maybe a slightly different sense of rhythm. I suppose what I've done here is more like fine-tuning what I think is my style, which is to always privilege the actors over the camera, and to understand that filmmaking is a very collaborative art. And you work with the crew, but mostly you work with the actors. That's what it's all about. And some of us, including myself, at the beginning of the New Wave, we were on a sort of ego trip. We were the first one to claim that the director was everything.
Mm-hmm.
The script was not important. In a way, the actors were like Hitchcock was saying, actors were objects. I've come back from that. 100%. I think now that I keep thinking and I keep telling my technicians, we're not on the screen. The actors are on the screen, and they're the one who carry the picture. We must help them. We must submit to everything that's going to make their work, which is very difficult, easier. And so that's what I've been trying to do all these years. But here, where the director is not as this sort of egomaniac they often are in Europe, that's maybe one of the things I've learned working here. And I think it's good in a way, because I'm very conscious of my privileges, and being the director, I'm the one who's supposed to make the final decisions. In the case of Au revoir les enfants, I wrote it, I directed it, I produced it. It's completely my work in a way. But the one thing I can say, I think if it works, it's because the people on the screen are great.
We only have a minute left. Two things I want to ask you very quickly. One is, you said you think your rhythm has changed a little since you moved to America. How so?
Well, it's just because when I'm comparing my work here, or even Au revoir les enfants, to a film like La Comble du Sien was much slower. Au revoir les enfants, which is a chronicle, which becomes a tragedy, if you want to simplify. I was just trying to accumulate little details at the beginning to show what it was to be a child in those years in a school, and you know, there's a lot of that. But I was very preoccupied with to keep the structure sort of flowing, which is something that I suppose I've learned here.
We only have a couple of seconds left, but very briefly, do you still plan on staying in America?
Well, I'm here for the time being, and I don't have any project at the moment. This film has been so important for me that I need to take a little time off, and I'm based here. I'm living here for the time being, and I would be very happy to work here again, provided I can work in complete freedom and provided I find something that really excites me.
Well, I want to thank you so much for talking with us about your work, and congratulations on your Academy Award nominations. Thank you.
Thank you, Terry.
Film director Louis Malle spoke to us from the NPR Bureau in New York. His new film, Au revoir les enfants, has just been nominated for 2 Academy Awards for Best Foreign Language Film and for Best Screenplay. Some of his earlier films include La Comble du Sien, Murmur of the Heart, Atlantic City, and My Dinner with André. I'm Terry Gross, and this is Fresh Air.
Funding for Fresh Air is provided by a major grant from the Corporation for Public Broadcasting and a grant from Fisher's World Travel Guides. Fisher's World Guidebooks featuring the removable travel planner designed for the intelligent, inquisitive traveler. Additional support comes from the listeners of WHYY-FM in Philadelphia, where Fresh Air is produced. This is NPR, National Public Radio. Thank you.
From Philadelphia, I'm Terry Gross, and this is Fresh Air. Virginia Woolf said that writers must be androgynous. Best-selling novelist Rita Mae Brown takes it one step further and says you must be bisexual. Coming up on Fresh Air, we discuss the advice she offers in her new writer's manual, Starting from Scratch. Also, Mick Maloney performs a couple of traditional Irish songs in our weekly performance spot. And critic-at-large Laurie Stone reviews comedian Rodney Dangerfield's one-man show on Broadway. That's all coming up on Fresh Air. First, the news from National Public Radio. This is Fresh Air. Irish musician and folklorist Mick Maloney is joining us again today for our weekly performance spot. He's brought along his guitar and mandolin. Mick grew up in County Limerick and studied traditional music there and in neighboring County Clare. But the tunes he's going to play and sing for us are part of an Irish music scene that grew up outside of Ireland.
It seems to have been the lot of many young Irish people for well over 100 years now to travel, to go abroad, and not just to sightsee or to visit, but to make a living. Just the harsh economic realities of the circumstances really are behind that massive population movement, which has really drained the life's blood of the country in many ways. When I was growing up in Ireland, you didn't really have the option to go to America. The quota had been abolished from Ireland, and England was the place to go to find work. And I went over to London, spent a few years there. The very, very first job I ever got over there was in the construction business. And funnily enough, the workers there who wouldn't listen to music at all back home, to Irish music, found that music and the bars and the social clubs became a sort of a mechanism for them to get together, to, you know, remove the loneliness and show their Irishness. And it was there I learned a song like this, this particular one, which came out of the construction business, a song called Crooked Jack.
Come Irish men, both brave and stern, with adventure in your soul. There are better ways to earn your bread than working down a hole. I was tall and through all of 6'2", but they broke me across the back. By a name I know, though it's not my own, they call me Crooked Jack. The ganger's blue-eyed boy was I, old Jack, he could do no wrong. And the reason simply was because I could work hard hours and long. I was tall and through all of 6'2", but they broke me across the back. By a name I know, though it's not my own, they call me Crooked Jack. I remember the day when I first went away to work on the hydro dams. My hopes and fears and my sweat and tears were bound up in those shuttering jams. I was tall and through all of 6'2", but they broke me across the back. By a name I know, though it's not my own, they call me Crooked Jack. I've seen men old before their time, their faces lined and grey. I never thought that I myself would soon be that self-same way. I was tall and through all of 6'2", but they broke me across the back. By a name I know, though it's not my own, they call me Crooked Jack. They say that honest toil is good for the body and the soul. But believe me, boys, it's just sweat and blood when you're working down a hole. I was tall and through all of 6'2", but they broke me across the back by a name I know, though it's not my own. They call me Crooked Jack.
Well, songs like Crooked Jack came out of a harsh reality. Not all the songs were sad, of course, and the instrumental tunes, they were lively, and people danced to them, and a lot of the immigrant musicians who played in London became very famous back in Ireland, made records over there, and those records were bought by people in Ireland, but also by the Irish transplanted population in England. And I used to play an awful lot in the social clubs in London, and I was lucky enough to be able to make my living as a professional musician for a good few years, travelling around the country. And that was the time when Irish music was really going through a renaissance in England, and the folk club scene was very accommodating, particularly to Irish instrumental music. And there was a great interest in the music of Turlough O'Carolan, the great Irish harper. And I remember learning some tunes over there. And, well, this is an O'Carolan piece. I didn't learn it till I actually came to America, but it's a sort of tune that was very popular in the folk clubs in England and became popular over here in America later on in the 70s. It's called Planxty Loftus Jones. Planxty Loftus Jones there, a 17th composition by Turlough O'Carolan, the great Irish harper.
Mick Maloney lives in Philadelphia, where in 1977 he founded the Folklife Center. He also produces records, manages tours, and lectures on Irish folk traditions. This is Fresh Air. Rita Mae Brown's 1973 autobiographical novel, Ruby Fruit Jungle, was probably the first modern novel about a lesbian to break through into the mass market and become a commercial success. After several other best-selling novels and screenplays, Brown has written a manual for writers called Starting from Scratch. Her advice to writers is as unconventional as the characters in her novels. In the book, she quotes Somerset Maugham, who wrote that there are three things you need to know to be a good writer. The problem is, no one knows what they are. I asked her in that case, why did she want to write a book of advice for writers?
I wanted to save them the problems that I had. These aren't rules for writing a novel. In a sense, this is a survival manual. I mean, if you want the technical stuff, like how to construct a plot, you should go somewhere else, not to my book, Starting from Scratch. Because what this book tries to do is to get you to imagine things in new ways, and also, very simply, to take care of your body. There's an awful lot of self-destructive behavior among writers, and I really like to put that in the garbage can.
Since this book is based on problems that you've had to overcome as a writer and experiences that you've had as a writer that you'd like to pass on, I thought what I would do is quote some of the advice that you give and see how that has applied in your own life. You write, art in our country is perceived as a feminine activity.
It is. All of the emotions are perceived of as feminine territory. This is not accurate. And art is about emotions. You can't be an artist if you aren't willing to live every day with emotions and to try to bring them forth in some way so other people can see them.
Because art is sometimes seen as a female activity, you're right, that a lot of men coming of age, that the parents get really upset and say, oh gosh, did I raise a fairy for for a son? He's going to be an artist. Have you compared notes with men friends of yours about the different experiences you had and they had coming of age and going into the arts?
I have indeed. And I've come to the conclusion that although I was pushed aside and denigrated because I was a female, and of course because I loved women and didn't make any bones about it, it still wasn't as bad as what the heterosexual man goes through. They are humiliated in a variety of subtle and not so subtle ways. And this is a peculiarly American phenomena. This isn't happening in Brazil. This isn't happening in France. This is happening here because we're very uncomfortable with emotions. And art, again, is about emotions.
You write, Virginia Woolf said that writers must be androgynous. I'll go a step further. You must be bisexual.
Oh, I knew you'd get to that. Yes, I think you do have to understand both sexes intimately. Now, you can get away with not sleeping with both sexes. That's up to you. But I think you have to understand how a man loves a woman, and you have to understand how a woman loves a man. You have to understand a man's fears and desires, and the same with a woman. And if you can wholeheartedly put yourself in another person's shoes, I don't think you're going to create very effective characters. But I think that physical knowledge is a great part of it. For instance, a little simple thing. You put your hands on a man's forearm, a muscular man. It is the most incredible sensation, these big, knotted forearms. Well, you don't get that sensation when you put your hands on a woman's forearm. Just the skin. I mean, a man's skin feels very differently than a woman's. Writing is tactile. It seems to me that that information is important to you.
But you write, is sex a universal symbol? No, absolutely not. Do you think that writers sometimes put too much weight on sex in their novel and expect sex to stand for more than it can hold up?
It's become a cliche.
Mm-hmm.
It's boring. And now it's gotten to the point where 10th-rate writers are doing it. Sex is a symbol for all of human experience. And, of course, sex is a plumbing exercise. Maybe there's some emotion attached to it, but a lot of times there isn't. The other thing is it's just cheap.
How is it cheap? In the way it's written about?
In the way it reduces relationships between men and women, and between women and women, and men and men, to sexual attraction. It's as though we can't conceive of anything other than sex between two people, that is the ultimate bond and that is the ultimate experience. Well, I'm here to tell you that is not true. To make that the ultimate experience cheapens human life, and it also makes for a lot of heterosexual problems because men and women have these exaggerated sexual expectations of one another. It seems to me we need to learn to be friends first.
I'm going to quote you again. The way I fashion dialogue for the middle class is I'm careful not to put in offensive metaphors. The speech is bland. It has to be. One of the ways a middle class person knows how to be bad is to be dirty, you say. So how does this figure in here? What are you saying about the middle class?
Well, first of all, I'm saying I'm not one of them.
Mm-hmm.
And I realized that my criticism is unwanted. It's unwanted knowledge. Middle-class people must please. Economically, they will lose their jobs if they don't please. And they're literally caught between the wealthy and the very poor. So they've created a behavior that is, in fact, pleasing. Middle-class people are nice. They're always nice. So that when they want to be bad or they want to rebel, they do things that are childish, or to someone like myself, appear childish. They'll write novels in which every third word is a four-letter word. They'll give stage shows or stand-up comic routines that are nothing but sex and smut. And to them, this is rebellion, and also they think it's funny. I think it shows a dearth of creativity, and I'd like them to get over it.
You have, I think, for most of your life, rebelled against authority and not accepted authority. You fought back when you thought it was appropriate. You're doing a lot of film and television work now, so your authority figures are producers. and in the book world, the authority figures are the editors and publishers. Do you feel free to fight back against authority in those kinds of professional settings when it's your work on the line, when you know if you get the reputation of being a troublemaker, you might not get asked to write that next screenplay?
That's a good question. I have to divide it between film and publishing. I can fight tooth and nail with my editor because we are of the same cloth. Publishing is a very genteel, bright, I'm not saying it isn't competitive, but these are terribly, terribly bright people in a way, or at least terribly well-educated. So we all know what we're fighting about, and we're usually fighting to make the work better.
Mm-hmm.
That's not true in Hollywood. Since October 19th, I have had 30 film and television offers.
Yipes.
I know, it's amazing. And the reason is because I don't drink, I don't take drugs, and I deliver on time. That makes me a miracle out there. Well, how did I make a decision? I didn't make a decision on how much money they were going to pay me. I make a decision based on the producer, her or himself. Who is this person? What is their track record? Have they done quality work? What do other writers and actors say who have worked with them? And so I have weeded out, even before I start, the people that I consider pretty awful. Although sometimes you'll still hit one. You think you've got a good person and it's time to shoot the movie, and the next thing you know, it's all tits and ass.
So you'll fight when you have to?
Yes, I will. I will. And you almost always lose. The power is the producer.
You give so much advice in your new book. Are there people who really gave you advice that have helped that's helped you through your career?
Yes, but they haven't been other writers.
Mm-hmm.
I've learned a great deal from actors.
Really?
Yeah. I've been very fortunate in some of the older people that I met when I was young. Ernest Borgnine, for example, once took me to dinner with his wife, Tuva, and gave me some of the best advice anyone's ever given me.
What was it?
About Hollywood. He said, never look poor. He said, I don't care if you haven't eaten in a week. Don't look poor. He said, because if they smell that you're poor, they'll rip your throat out. And he was absolutely right.
Is this just Hollywood that applies to, or is that publishing too?
No, publishing doesn't care. Publishing people are very, very different. Another person that helped me in the very start of my career was an actress, Alexis Smith, who I deviled. I was really not. I wish I had been nicer to that woman. I was a pest. But she told me to go towards the arts. She said, a lot of people can be political, a lot of people can run for office, but not very many people have imagination. She said, you have imagination. Go with it.
Rita Mae Brown's new book is called Starting from Scratch, A Different Kind of Writer's Manual. This is Fresh Air. All Things Considered is coming up with full coverage of today's news. Let's check in with Robert Siegel and see what they have planned. Hi, Robert.
Hello, Terry.
What stories are you following?
Well, we talk with an expert on the Pollard case. Remember the Israeli spying case? Who doubts a Washington Post, in fact, a Bob Woodward report today, that there is evidence of another and higher-ranking Israeli agent somewhere inside the U.S. government. Also, we follow Chancellor Helmut Kohl's visit to Washington and his talks with President Reagan. One of the issues, why the Germans oppose modernizing some short-range nuclear missiles, which the U.S. wants to modernize. And from Calgary in Canada, an introduction to curling game. It's sort of like, I think it's like bocce on ice with brooms.
Thanks, Robert. Those stories and more coming up on All Things Considered from National Public Radio. Comic Rodney Dangerfield has been doing his stand-up routines for years. He also has a club in New York where he showcases young comics. And in the past decade, he's taken on roles in movies like Back to School and Caddyshack, which have won him a new audience of young people. Dangerfield recently did a one-man show on Broadway, and our critic-at-large, Laurie Stone, was there.
I'd never seen him live, and the short bits he does on talk shows don't adequately explain why so many hip young comedians credit his influence. I understand now. Dangerfield is a bridge between the Borscht Belt and confessional humor. He shares a machine gun delivery and dancer's timing with Henny Youngman, but Youngman's manner is sunny and masked. You don't have a clue what drives him to tell jokes. Dangerfield's material grows from inside. Sadness rises from him, surrounds him. He's sad because he's clumsy and fat. He feels isolated and inept. No joke. And because the sadness is real, because the tie touching and squirming come from his gut, the comedy he spins from it is rich and conscious. His head is a filing cabinet stuffed with jokes about failure and humiliation, about Rodney's childhood. I was an ugly kid. My father never took me to the zoo. He said, if they want you, they'll come get you. His dentist cleans his teeth, and they're still yellow. The dentist says, wear a brown tie. Rodney gets a dog, hoping it'll help him meet girls. It turns out the dog is using me to meet other dogs. The audience, who are mostly under 30, love Dangerfield's vulgarity, and it is often winning. For the most part, he uses his outsider identity to make social points. His schlub persona, refreshingly, isn't based on being Jewish, he is, but on being low class. The stage name, Rodney Dangerfield, is a WASP tease, and the inclusion of the word danger tweaks his victim role. But he's not just a loser. He doesn't get respect, but neither does he fawn to fanciness. He looks around the spiffy theater. Mark Hellinger, big deal. What do you say we bust up this place? He hates moralists and won't say no to drugs. He joined AA but still drinks. I use another name. And ineffectual though he is at getting dates, he's still dying to screw. He makes fun of snobs without trashing knowledge, and while there's nothing unusual about his view of life, there is something special about the degree of his candor and vulnerability. He never stoops to sentimentality or kitschy commentary on his role. His tough-mindedness lifts him from sap status and compels us to laugh at the schlub in us. I laugh steadily for 20 minutes, even at wife jokes. Mostly Dangerfield makes fun of his ineptness with women, ceding them appetite and savoir-faire. My kids are good-looking. Thank God my wife cheats on me. After 20 minutes, though, I laughed only intermittently. The material gathers no vision or thematic shape. Even more problematic, an angry flip side of Dangerfield's vulgarity surfaces, and this, alas, has been passed on to younger comics, too, Sam Kinison and Bob Nelson among them. Dangerfield has spent too much time feeling women's power over him not to feel rage at them also, and when he caves into anxiety, his femme fatale becomes a slut. He also makes fun of gays. At the low point of opening night, he offered a beautiful woman his necktie for a kiss. She expected a benign peck. Instead, he grabbed her, planted his mouth on hers, twisted her back to the audience, and roughly squeezed her ass. The audience's response was shock more than amusement. When the comedian came back for an encore, he stared out and quietly said, "Now I'm going to tell you how blank and unhappy I am." He wasn't kidding. Dangerfield is an original, far more vivid on stage than in the movies. Catch him when he tours, but don't let him get away with cheap shots.
Laurie Stone is a New York-based writer and critic, and is a contributor to The Village Voice.
R-E-S-P-E-C-T, find out what it means to me.
Here's a look at the next Fresh Air. Next time I'll talk with Robert Hunter, the lyricist for most of the Grateful Dead's songs. He performs his own words and music on his new album, Liberty. Also, jazz critic Kevin Whitehead will review Repercussions, a documentary series on African and Afro-American music that features drummer Max Roach. And television critic David Bianculli will talk about what the VCR has done to his kids' TV viewing. So I hope you can join us. And we'd love to hear from you, so if you have a couple of minutes, drop us a line. Our address is Fresh Air, WHYY Radio, Independence Mall West, Philadelphia, Pennsylvania, 19106. That's Fresh Air, WHYY Radio, Independence Mall West, Philadelphia, Pennsylvania, 19106. We thank everyone who helps make Fresh Air possible.
Major funding for Fresh Air is provided by the Corporation for Public Broadcasting. Additional support comes from the listeners of WHYY in Philadelphia, where Fresh Air is produced.
Our senior producer is Danny Miller. Our producers are Amy Sallet, Phyllis Myers, and Naomi Person. Production assistants from Ed Doherty and Lisa Bruton. Our engineer is Joyce Lieberman. Chris Spurgeon directs the show. I'm Terry Gross. Thanks for listening. This is NPR, National Public Radio.